Jean Balance, and I'm coming to you from the EPA's Technology, Innovation, and Field Services Division, where I'll be serving as your moderator for our online broadcast. We're going to be joined today by our primary instructor, Fred McLean, from the Department of Navy in their Laboratory Quality Assurance Office. I'll cover a little bit of information about Fred, as well as the content that we'll cover on today's seminar in just a few moments, as well as some instructions on how you can actively join us for the online broadcast. Again, today's seminar is scheduled to run from 10 a.m. Eastern to 12 noon, and it's been sponsored by the Department of Navy and their Laboratory Quality Assurance Office. Our seminar today will look at DOE, Consolidated Quality Systems Manual, or QSM, for environmental laboratories, and it's a part of a training that is going to look at version 5.0. Before we kick off that technical portion of the broadcast, let me cover some of those instructions and reminders on how you can attend in today's seminar. When you signed up for today's broadcast, you would have been directed to something called the seminar homepage, and that would have been listed in an email as well as reminder message you received with complete descriptions on how to join us for the live broadcast. Again, referencing that seminar homepage, there will be a collection of items there about today's seminar, including a description of the event, contact information, as well as bios for myself and the other presenters. There are copies of the seminar materials that you can actually download, and if you're looking to take notes on hard copy, I'd refer you to find the files there and actually download them and print them at your own location. But most importantly, there's a button in the upper left corner that says Go to Seminar, and if you click that button, you'll be prompted to identify yourself, the number of people with you at your location, and then you can actually join us for the live online broadcast. If you have any problems joining us for the online broadcast, you can follow along via telephone and with an electronic or printed copy of the materials. Today's entire broadcast is going to be offered online through a new meeting tool called Adobe Connect, which will allow you to actually sit back and watch as our presenter delivers their training completely through the internet from their remote locations. We encourage all of our participants to actively join us for that online broadcast and actually listen to this session through their computer or mobile device. The materials, again, are available to download if you have technical problems, but there may be some elements that you miss out on without that full interactive online experience. So if you're having problems, go ahead and send me an email, and I'll be happy to work with you to troubleshoot those issues. Audio for the session will be delivered online through Adobe Connect, so you should be able to hear me through your computer or mobile device. If you're having any problems with that online audio, the first thing I'd ask you to do is check your local volume settings. Try to turn up your speakers as loud as you can. Sometimes you may need to go into the sound control settings on your computer and actually boost your speaker output. Some participants have found that using a pair of headphones can greatly help the audio volume. If that still doesn't work for you, I do have free toll-free call-in information I'll be happy to share with anyone who needs it. So simply send me a message in the Q&A window, and I'll be happy to share that call-in number with anyone who has problems with the online audio. But please know, if you're on the telephone lines, you will be globally muted, and I'd ask that you remain globally muted to help cut down on background noises or other disruptions. For Q&A for today's seminar, we do have a window that's open in the lower right corner of your screen. There's already a welcome message from me there. You can type up comments, questions, report technical difficulties at any time in that window, again, by typing in the very bottom of the right corner of your screen and hitting enter or pressing the little cartoon bubble. We will not be answering technical questions live during today's broadcast, but we will be collecting those questions and then sending them off to a team to get a response after the live broadcast. So we encourage you to go ahead and type up comments and questions as they occur to you during today's training. But please know we won't necessarily be answering the technically directed questions live today. If you have other questions regarding how to access slides, where can you go for more information, by all means, go ahead and type those up at any point, and we'll be happy to work with you during today's seminar. Lastly, just wanted to remind everybody that today's seminar is being recorded and will be archived automatically on the CRUIN website. Usually takes us about 1 to 2 weeks. And you'll automatically get an email as soon as that archive is available for free replay. So you're certainly welcome to forward that on to anybody that you think will find this to be valuable. And if you like what you're hearing today, we do online training like this almost on a daily basis on CLUED. And we have over 500 archive seminars currently available for free replay on our website. So again, one more quick reminder. You should see a window here. I'm just going to close out this window here and maximize our slides again, so we can prepare for our technical portion of the broadcast today. The majority of your screen is going to be occupied by a window showing the PowerPoint presentation today. And I'm going to pull that up in just one moment. Those slides will actively change as our presenter goes through his material. So if you have any problems with that, use the Q&A window to report it. If you'd like to, there's a full screen button you can use in the upper right corner of that window that will actually expand the size of the slides and make them larger. If you want to turn that view off, simply press the full screen button again. You can kind of click in and click out of the full screen view as many times as necessary. To the right, you'll find some of those important windows I referenced earlier, including our Sponsored By logo. There's also a collection of related websites just below that. You can click on any one of those websites, press the Browse To button, and that will open them locally on your own computer. And then just below that, again, is that all-important Q&A window where you can type up your comments, questions, or report any technical difficulties. Again, at any point, feel free to type messages up into that window. I think that's the end of the technical reminders that I have for today's session. So I'm going to get ready to turn things over to Fred McLean, who's joining us from the Navy Laboratory Quality and Accreditation Office. And before Fred begins his talk, let's give you a little bit of a background. Again, this actual presentation on the new Quality Systems Manual is the result of over 2 years of effort by a group of highly dedicated individuals from both the Department of Defense and the Department of Energy. They worked as a consensus group dedicated to improving the quality of laboratory data reported to state and federal agencies like the EPA. Our presenter today is Fred McLean, a Department of Navy chemist, who is the chairman of the group who's responsible for creating this particular document. He has 30 years of laboratory and environmental project experience, and I hope everybody, there's, again, nearly 250 individuals who have already signed in online. So, again, I welcome everybody, and I hope you can all join me in a warm welcome to Fred McLean. Fred, whenever you're ready.
Okay, thank you, Jean. Let's see. Yes. I have control now, and I want to just, first of all, thank everyone for joining us here on this webinar. I know we had a lot of questions about just simply the fact that for some of you it's very, very early in the morning, those on the West Coast and in Alaska, and we've also got some other overseas labs. And so since it was kind of a global, you know, participation from everyone here, we had a difficult time really trying to determine an optimum time for everyone. So first off, I just want to apologize to all of you who are getting up very, very early in the morning, or those of you who are about to go to bed. The first and last things in the day that you really want to talk about is the QSM. So with that, we'll continue on. And what I'm going to focus on today is going to simply be the new DOE QSM. We spent, like Jean said, about 2 years working on this. And so I guess the best place to start is right at the beginning. And what you're going to see as a laboratory and as our assessors, the DOD DOE QSM, it's now a standalone document. There are no more gray boxes like we used to have. The reason why we had to create a standalone document is, as many of you already know, there's a lot of copyright issues involved when you use ISO materials. We are using the ISO 17025 2005 version as the basis for our document. And we're also including in that the TNI Volume 1 September 2009. So our version QSM 5.0 essentially just is additional requirements for those other two documents. So unfortunately, for anyone involved in our program, you're going to need all three. We were not able to really get around that copyright issue, so this became, you know, I guess you could say the best of a bad choice. And so with that, you're going to also see, right now we have a tentative title for it. It's just called DOD DOE Consolidated Quality Systems Manual for Environmental Laboratories. That may change, you know, depending on, you know, how it's signed out and who does it and what they want it to say. There could be a different title for this, but essentially it's going to be the QSM. Now, what you're going to see, depending on what your laboratory works for, whether you're working for DOD or DOE, is just simply the fact that for the DOD side, it will just be called QSM version 5.0. chances are if you're working for the DOE labs, you may see something slightly different. It'll just be the DOE quality systems for analytical services version 3.0. Just to make everyone understand, this is a very important point. Both documents are the same. They're just going to be titled differently. And the reason why that came about is just simply for the fact that, you know, we have a lot of contracts out there that reference certain things like the QSM. And for DOE, it may reference the QSAS. And so to get around the fact we don't want all these contracts to have to be rewritten, we've essentially given this document multiple titles. So I strongly emphasize, everyone, please don't get confused by that. Whatever it's called, it is the same document, and it's used by both organizations. I'm just going to start right at the beginning. What I plan on doing is just going through all the modules that we had, you know, based on the TNI 2009 version, and just showing you some of the highlights of this. A lot of this stuff we've really been discussing since our last EMDQ meeting in 2012, and also our DOCAP meeting that we had back, I think, in September in Idaho Falls. So what we're essentially doing is telling you, you know, what were our final decisions on these things. Starting off with Module 1, proficiency testing, I would say probably the most important point here is that very first one. What we wanted to do with the NELAC language is to kind of open it up a little bit. This was actually a response from some of our accreditation bodies that also felt this was a better way to go. Essentially, what we're doing is requiring all the PT samples to meet these ISO 17043 requirements for PT providers. Essentially, that is your overarching requirement for PTs for us. If you have these 17043 providers, wherever they are, whether they're within the NELAC umbrella or not, to us, isn't going to matter. As long as they have this accreditation, that's where you go to first. The other things that you'll see, for us, DOD, we do require that, you know, you have PT samples for whatever is on your scope of accreditation. I don't think that's changed really from our policies before. We do require, you know, the PTs twice a year, except for your tox studies, which I think we only require once a year. This is another important point here, and what this bullet is essentially telling you here is that our acceptance or failure of a PT is really provided to you by the PT provider. DOD and DOE are not going to get into, I would say, arguments with PT providers over exactly what they consider to be an acceptance or a failure. That's really between the accreditation bodies and the ISO 17043 providers. In case there's some issues over how things pass or fail, as I reemphasize, DOD really isn't going to get involved in all that as determining whether something is acceptable or not. If it's acceptable to the PT providers, then it's going to be acceptable for us. Now, one of the good things, exciting things we think that'll come out of this is simply the fact that we do have, for DOE, they use the MAPEP program, which is their Mixed Analyte Performance Evaluation Program, mostly for their radiochemistry stuff for DOE. Since they're already ISO 17043 accredited, as of now, they're also allowed by DOD. So if there's any DOD labs out there that would like to participate in the MAPEP program, you can give those guys a call. My understanding is that it doesn't really cost anything. They're already centrally funded. So, you know, you just give those guys a call, and they can certainly work with you to add you onto their list providing PTs. It's another tool for you guys, for the labs out there, for whatever they want to use, you know, to meet these PT requirements for us. We do give, you know, there's always exceptions, and for DOD, we got always seem to have a lot of them. We do give, I think, very thorough instructions in this module. There are cases where you just do not have ISO 17043 PTs for certain analytes. Sometimes you don't have any PTs at all. In those cases, we go through an explanation of how you can work with your ABs on the DOD side in order to make sure that, you know, whatever ends up on your scope of accreditation has some sort of either a PT sample with it, or in those very, very rare cases where there are not PTs available, you can use the NELAC language, the TNI language that's already there, into how you can show, you know, proficiency through precision and bias and those things. So I think that's pretty much it for Module 1. Like I said, the 17043 issue is probably the main thing that we made a decision on. That's going to have an effect on us. Moving into Module 2, which is your quality systems module, we did make what I would consider the more global changes as best we could. And I think we've done a very good job of this, is to mark each section of our document, whether it's a requirement, a clarification of a NELAC or ISO text, which is also a requirement, or just flat out some little bit of guidance that we added in there. As best we could, it's all very well laid out, and guidance is simply guidance. You can use it or not at your leisure. We've also, as telling you that requirements and the clarifications are mandatory for the labs that seek the DOD ELAP accreditation. Which shouldn't be a surprise to anyone. What we tried to do to make sure everyone understood that, where we added the text, we tried to make sure that we said that it was like in addition to or in lieu of something that's already in an existing text for like the TNI document. And we always refer to everything, what we're talking about is either ISO clauses or TNI text. We do have one section that, and there are a few cases in the document where certain things really pertain to either DOD or DOE. For example, I just lost my connectivity here. Oops. Hold on just a second here. But I will go on and just talk about the text that you will see in referencing what I call like RAD safety, RAD health, that's DOE for the DOE laboratories. That section is marked as DOE only. There are a few other sections in there that really refer more to the DOD ELAP accreditation process, and which, you know, doesn't really have anything much to do with DOE. So in those few cases, you will see some text that just says DOD only. And again, that's really mainly because of what we have done due to our trying to make sure that people were able to separate between, you know, like what is DOE and their DOCAP program and those few things for DOD that refers to accreditation. Again, if you're an assessor, probably the most important takeaway message from this, from a global standpoint, is just simply the fact that you're going to need both. You know, the ISO text, the 17025-2005 document, and the TNI standard. And our QSM 5.0 as well. So it is, I apologize in advance for everyone from DOD and DOE, to everyone out there that's going to have to assess to this, it is going to be a little bit more difficult using all three manuals. We did make a few, I would say more or less ISO-related global changes that have been incorporated into the manual now. I think I've gone over these before, but for everyone out there, there are just certain terms that are more ISO requirement type terms, like client and customer and documents and records. So we made all those global changes in there. Going on. Looking at some just specifics of what I consider, and like I said, this training is really going to focus on the changes that we made that we felt were very, very important for everyone to understand. One of the first things we did is we actually removed all that section that talks about technical qualifications. It's no longer in our standard. We're referring back to the TNI language that's there. That's also, it's in the TNI 2009 document, so it's there. There's no need to repeat it in our QSM. We made a few additions, just simple additions, really, to some of the ISO text for, like, document control. Essentially, all your reviews of your management system documentation, whenever someone comes in to assess you, that has to be available. You would think that would be kind of self-evident, but in a lot of cases it isn't. So everything that you are responsible for in terms of document control, when our creditors come in there, they have that ability to go through and look at those documents. One other change is made that we've been going, you know, one of those issues that, you know, that always seems to polarize our group is just simply the fact that when we have documents that are part of your quality system, we expect those documents, wherever they are part of your management system. So if you got like what I like to call cheat sheets, operator aids, charts, all those things that may be up on the walls that people have just essentially just scribbled out notes for themselves, if they're used on like a day-to-day basis and you have it there as an operator instruction, then that has to be part of your quality system. They're subject to document control. So as a laboratory, your choices is either get rid of all that stuff or incorporate all that stuff into your system. As we move on into section 455, this first bullet really pertains more to the DoD ELAP. And all we're essentially saying is subcontracting in support of any of our restoration projects, you have to be accredited. So all your subcontracted labs have to be accredited. Now, again, there are those instances where you have these really odd situations. We expect them to be very, very infrequent. But you do have these odd situations where we may have to step in as DoD and look at those labs that for whatever reasons, doing some kind of unique test that cannot get accredited. But we expect that to be on a very infrequent basis. We've also had a number of labs that have asked us, you know, well, what about if I want to subcontract, say, my data review systems to someone else outside or external to my laboratory and let them do the data review and send it back to me. What we have said is essentially that is okay. You can do that. But whomever you subcontract to, they also must comply with the requirements of the QSM where applicable. So they also form a part of your quality system. And so it's up to you, I guess, as a laboratory from a business perspective to see whether this is advantageous or not. We are saying you can do it, but if you do it, they have to also fall within your requirements as a laboratory. On service to the client here, we did have a few instances where it was in the previous version of our QSM where we were talking about feedback from the customer. Those requirements, we used to just have that as guidance, but a number of people asked us and said, really, that should be requirements almost as a bare minimum of things that you should get feedback from your customer on. Specifically, like when someone wants isolated, incorrect or obsolete methods, they need method modifications, they need you as a laboratory need different project planning documents that are missing, problems that you encounter with sampling analysis that may impact your results. What we're essentially saying is you're required as a laboratory to obtain feedback from your clients in order to resolve these kinds of issues. There are many cases, and we understand this, where you, as a laboratory, know that the method that the client wants is obsolete and out of date, and yet they still want to use it. And we are saying, as you know, part of DOD ELAP, that's if the client wants to use that, there may be many, many reasons why you would want to use an obsolete method. Maybe you're looking for a site history over a number of years. They can still do it. All we're asking for the laboratories is that you obtain through your email system somehow some kind of documentation that shows that you have alerted your client that maybe these methods are obsolete. They still want to use them. You got your documentation. And as far as the accreditation process is concerned, that's acceptable. It's up to us on the other side of the fence, you know, from a project standpoint, to really look into issues like this and maybe help the projects when they're really trying to use inappropriate methods. Another strong addition that we put in here on corrective actions, what we're essentially saying, we're putting it in writing that it says, you know, on any assessment that you have, whatever corrective actions that are generated through these assessments, you basically have to implement them. And if you decide to implement them and you want to make changes to your corrective action plans, you essentially just need approval from either your ELAP accreditation bodies or your DOCAP operations team. And essentially what we're telling you is, you know, if you don't want to make these corrective actions, you don't want to implement the changes that are needed for our programs, you know, it may lead to a loss of work. It's just a simple, you know, just a flat statement there. We had a few what I call technical things to go over. Just quickly, in this section 533B, we talked about storage blanks. We've gone back and forth as a committee on this as to what is a really good time frame for doing these. We polled a number of our laboratories, and it seemed to be that 14 days was a typical standard for everyone. And so this made it a little bit clearer, really, for our assessors as to how often, you know, should a laboratory do these storage blanks. So we're essentially, you know, looking through what the laboratories were doing. We just kind of codified the fact that storage blanks are analyzed at a minimum every 14 days. We did have a couple cases where just some preface material in section 546 for some T&I language and from 5.6 some ISO language, we just added it back into the document, and both of these cases were essentially just some preface material on uncertainty, and in section 5.6 measurement traceability. It was kind of missing from the T&I. I think it just inadvertently got left out, and so we just added it back in. We also added one section here on data control, just talking a little bit in a little bit more detail on data security of your LIM systems and the requirements there. And another issue from the technical standpoint on these glass microliter syringes. There is a requirement, of course, that, you know, when you get syringes that they have to, you know, you need to know the precision and the bias of that. The problem is when you get to these microliter size syringes, it's not really possible to do that. Nobody has a balance that accurate or a clean room that's going to be that stable to allow these kinds of measurements for these like 10 microliter syringes. And so what we're saying to get around essentially that requirement. What we're saying is you just need your general certificate of bias and precision. If you have that, that is, of course, part of your uncertainty calculations, your uncertainty budget, as you will. You certainly need to know that information, but for now what we're saying is those general certificates will suffice for our programs. Another issue I think we finally came to consensus on, expiration dates. One of our previous, I think version 4.2, we were kind of asking you if something didn't come with an expiration date from the manufacturer, we expected you through some technical justification to come up with an expiration date. We heard feedback from a lot of our labs that, you know, doing a study on, say, sodium chloride to determine shelf life really doesn't have a lot of point to it, and we agreed that for a lot of these, especially reagents, a lot of, you know, of your salts stay forever, so there really isn't no need for all these technical studies to determine a shelf life for it. So what we ended up doing is just saying we're just going to follow what the T&I standard already says. If the manufacturer does not require or assign a date to it, then it's not going to be required for our program. One big addition that we have here for our Module 2 quality systems, and it's very important people understand this, we added the section on what we call legal chain of custody. This only applies, and it's very important that everybody understand this, this only applies when you need those protocols, when you're working on samples that are being litigated. Chances are the lawyers themselves are going to give you the procedure they expect the lab to follow. And if they give you those procedures, then we are perfectly fine with that. This section only applies when no one gives you any requirements for how you're supposed to do a legal chain of custody. These requirements were then added into our document, our QSM 5, 5.0. You don't need these unless you're doing you need a legal chain of custody. Like I said, there's some kind of law involved in it, lawyers, some kind of litigation, and you don't have requirements already given to you by the litigating parties. So that's a good addition, we think, to the QSM, but it's going to be one of those things that will probably be rarely invoked, or at least we hope so. And again, just a simple addition in 510, it just invokes our new Appendix A, which I'm going to go over for reporting results. And there is a new section that we have added, radioactive materials management. This entire section, that's just it's DOE only for the DOE rad labs. And that is for those. Now we made a few changes in Module 3, really just some additions on asbestos testing. The first thing I'll go over is the one on demonstration of capability. It gives you two options when you do a demonstration of capability. If something fails, you essentially could either correct the problem and then repeat the test. What we're trying to tell you is since you're doing demonstration of capability and it's really for the analyst, not necessarily for the system, we think the first thing you should do is just repeat the test. You repeat the test first, and then you, because you're really trying to determine whether your analyst is capable of doing it or not. And so you worry about the system after you determine whether your analyst can do the test. And the way you do that is just by repeating the test, not by interfering with your system. And you may find out that you do have a system problem. But we think on a demonstration of capability, your first focus should be on the actual individual and whether he's capable or not. We did have one change here on your microscope phase shift detection. It says it's got a monthly check. We changed that to daily. And, of course, after any modification. We've gone back. There's been some questions. What it really is meaning is daily or before use. So while you say it's daily, it's really right before you use it. So that was one slight change we made there. And then another one on polarized light microscopes alignment. We just gave a little bit more detail in this section here on doing your polarized light microscope alignments, giving you some detail and how you document that. And I believe for Module 3 asbestos, that was it. Module 4, this is our chemistry testing module. We haven't really made too many changes on our LOD and LOQ. It's essentially the same as it was in version 4.2, but we have clarified a few things just to make sure everybody understands this. These questions, are based on a lot of what we call feedback from just version 4.2 over the last year. What we're trying to say for everyone is that, you know, every one of your prep methods that's listed on your scope of accreditation, you've got to have those quarterly LOD and LOQ verifications. We have added a caveat in there that says there are situations where methods, you know, you're set up, you use them on a very, very infrequent basis. Maybe you're like in a mobile lab situation where you only mobilize for like one quarter out of the year. So does it make sense for you to do it on a quarterly basis? What we're saying that in those situations, you can do it on a one per batch basis. Now, here's the important take-home message for this one. It's an either-or situation. And as a laboratory, you know, you as a business, you got to decide, you know, which one makes more sense for you in terms of, you know, just how your business is run. You can do them every quarter, or you can do them every batch. There are going to be situations where it may be more advantageous to you to do them every batch, but that's your that's the requirements you have. It's going to be an either-or situation for you. We also clarified in this second bullet here, there are, you know, with preps and cleanups and all that, it can get very complex as to how you determine LODs and LOQs. And the question always comes up, do you need all possible combinations of these preps and cleanups for LODs and LOQs? The answer, the short answer is no, you don't. You do not have to perform them on all combinations, but you must base your LOD and LOQ verifications on your worst case basis. If you do that for us, then you have met this requirement. So not all combinations will be necessary. Now, if you do it on a worst case basis and you don't like your results, well, you may have to take a step back and decide to do individual combinations. That's a business decision for your laboratory. Finally, on the last bullet, we did make, it's just one slight change to make sure everybody understood this. When you determine your detection limit, you establish your LOD by spiking quality system matrix, a sample, at a concentration of at least 2, but no greater than 4 times the DL. That is what establishes your LOD. That is what becomes the concentration at which your LOD is verified. Like I said, that was just a slight change. I think we had it in a previous version. I think it was actually from 1 to 4, but 1 to 4 really doesn't meet the definition of LOD, so we essentially said at least 2, no greater than 4. In this section 1711, we're talking about second sources here. And the question always comes up, can I use a standard from a second lot obtained from the same manufacturer? That's come up a number of times because a lot of labs like to buy these packages of two separate sources from the same, I guess, vendor, manufacturer, as we say. And we're saying, yes, that is acceptable. You can do it. If they're independently prepared from different source materials, it's acceptable. If they can show you, you know, or they verify that, send you a document saying that they're doing it that way, and those things are independent source materials, then yes, you can get it from the same manufacturer or same vendor, depending on how you get your standards. Now, Section 172 on CCV seems like a lot, and I am not going to read all of that. But what this essentially does is, if you go through it, it's almost like a stepwise process because, again, this is another one of those issues that keep popping up for us that laboratories were asked, you know, when my CCV fails, what am I supposed to do? You know, how do I address this? And it gets very, very complicated as to how you evaluate CCVs. So what we hope we've done is kind of clarified it for everyone is what do I do when my CCV fails? And what we're trying to tell you is the first thing you do is if you can immediately go back and reanalyze two consecutive CCVs, if you have a CCV failure within like that 1 hour, you can do that, and if they both pass, then you can say, yeah, I don't have to go back and reanalyze any samples. My CCV failure may have been some kind of spurious event that didn't cause a problem with my data. Again, what we're saying is both of these have to be acceptable in order for samples to be reported without reanalysis or without qualification. What we're saying is if either of the two additional CCVs you've done cannot be immediately analyzed or the associated samples, you're not going to be able to report those samples. They're going to have to be reanalyzed, or in cases where you can't reanalyze them, you're essentially going to have to go back and maybe even recalibrate, do some kinds of problem solving with your system, and if that scenario fails. What we're trying to do is kind of separating what we consider the more spurious events where you got long lists of analytes and you can't get your CCVs to work for all the compounds. You can go back in and try and see if that was just some kind of spurious event versus when you actually got like a system problem where you got to go back in and make changes to your system, which would, of course, require you to reanalyze those samples since your last successful CCV. And again, we reemphasize in the last bullet that flagging is only appropriate when you can't go back and reanalyze samples. And I believe we've had that, you know, since previous version 4.2. Now, here's where I would consider to be a very big change. And as I go through this and talk about our LCS study, this is a really big change for us in how we are going to evaluate laboratories based on their LCSs that were created. First of all, we say that control limits. We've always had a requirement that you had to evaluate your control limits, mainly just to see, you know, whether you're trending upwards or downwards. The question came from our accreditors as to how often should laboratories look at control limits. They want some kind of time frame on it, so after a lot of back and forth with our work group, we said that, you know, if you're monitoring for trends, you should be doing this at least quarterly. So somewhere in your documentation showing that you have control limits and you're actually monitoring these, someone is evaluating these trends at least on a quarterly basis. We also, and I think this is also in version 4.2, we don't expect laboratories to look at every single compound in their laboratory. They can choose what they consider to be their representative compounds for the purposes of trend analysis. Now, again, that's for trend analysis, and that's not necessarily for all. You have to develop in-house control limits for everything, but you, as far as looking at trends, you can just determine based on your total number of analytes which ones you want to evaluate. Again, in the next bullet, we reemphasize you must use your in-house control limits for the purpose of trend analysis. And you may, again, that is a may, if you want to, may use your in-house control limits as components for estimating your uncertainty, where that's required by ISO. You certainly can use those values. And this third bullet, which is very, very important, I'll go over it a little bit more when we get to the LCS appendix that we've added. When you're reporting data for DOD, DOE, those Appendix C tables, the limits that are in there, shall be used when reporting data. And what we are telling our accreditation bodies is that laboratories must develop processes or procedures to incorporate these new limits. So in terms of what you're going to get from our assessments is they're going to be looking at your in-house limits to see if you're using them for trend analysis and that all the analytes on your scope of accreditation are also have in-house control limits. But when it comes to reporting data, you're going to use the Appendix C limits. Now, one of the things this eliminates, and it's very important to understand, is our assessors are not going to be going into your laboratory and comparing the Appendix C limits to your in-house limits. That is not their function. Their function is to make sure those Appendix C limits have been incorporated into your systems, data systems, LIMS, however you do it, to where when you report data, that's what you're reporting as our LCS limits. The only caveat we have for that is, of course, if a project has their own limits, which are outside of the scope of our Appendix C, new Appendix C limits, that's what they have to use for reporting. So that's pretty much the only exception. So that is a big change from what we were doing in version 4.2. And as a follow-on to that, these Appendix C tables are now what you use for batch control, unless the projects give you something else. So you're using the Appendix C tables for reporting on your reports, and you're using them for batch control. And the process of, you know, that we have this NTNI of your sporadic marginal exceedances, all that is still there and it's still applicable. The only exception, of course, for any marginal exceedance is whenever you have certain risk drivers that are a project identifies as a target analyte or a risk driver, you need project approval if those fall outside of these DOD limits. Another important point for here is there are going to be those cases. Those Appendix C limits, I'm guessing around 1,200 analytes on that list. It still doesn't cover everything that we're looking for. There are going to be those cases where we just don't have limits for the Appendix C compounds that clients may want on their scope of accreditation. That's okay, not a problem. In those cases, that's where you will default back to your in-house control limits. That takes over for your batch control and your data reporting if it's not in Appendix C. And finally, this last bullet, I'm going to reemphasize this again. This is for DOD. This is a DOD-only requirement because it is part of our DOD ELAP accreditation. And what we're essentially saying to you is laboratories must develop in-house control limits for all analytes on their scope of accreditation. Those in-house control limits are used for trend analysis and batch control for those analytes not listed in Appendix C. I hope through all this language, I know it's a little, it is different from what we had in version 4.2, but hopefully as you read through QSM version 5, it'll become more clear to you as you use this. That was probably our, I would say, the main change that we had in Module 4 to chemistry is how we are evaluating LCS limits. Here is an important, this 1736 is a very important, what I call technical clarification that we've made as a group. Those HPLC UV diode array detectors are not considered confirmation for a UV detector. So even though they're two separate detectors there, our group went over a lot of data looking at this, and right now as it stands, as technology stands today, we don't feel like that the UV diode array is adequate confirmation for this. Our opinions on this change, for version 5.0, this is what we have, but as technology improves, we can certainly revisit this in the future. There have been a number of labs that have pointed out to us, you know, that it looks like some of the detectors are getting a little bit better. That may be the case. When we get to that point where we're confident in the data as being used for confirmation, we'll certainly remove this requirement from the document. But for right now, for version 5.0, what we're saying is the diode array detectors is not confirmation when you use a UV detector. This one here, again, just reemphasizing that we do allow sporadic marginal exceedances, just like it is in the TNI document. However, if they are chemicals of concern identified by the project, target analytes do not fall under marginal exceedance rules, and so, you know, that would be considered an LCS failure if they didn't fall within their control limits. Again, chemicals of concern, this is where it's very important to talk to your clients. There may be cases where your client would find it acceptable that you're outside of those limits for, you know, various reasons. But you do need that project-specific approval if they have target analytes that they want that you say, you know, may not fall within the limits they're looking for. We did add this because a number of labs have asked us to really identify and define what a target analyte is. So we did, I guess, to the best of our abilities, to try to do that. We consider a target analyte those few analytes that are critical to the success of a project. Most people would call those risk drivers. This is where sporadic marginal exceedances cannot be allowed. And again, we reemphasize labs should consult with clients whenever long lists of analytes are requested and just to determine if they're going to allow marginal exceedances. You know, that was pretty much it as far as technical requirements for Module 4. As we see here in the micro section, Module 5, we didn't change anything at all. We just pretty much defaulted to the, and we did, had a number of microbiologists go over it, Module 5, and they were satisfied with, you know, what was the language that was already there. And I will emphasize again on the TOX Module 7, we didn't have any changes to the TNI language. So the TNI language is the default there. Now, one of the things we did for Module 6, and I'm just going to briefly mention this, One of the things we found as a group when we were going over all the comments that we got back from various laboratories is there seemed to be a split within our RadChem laboratories. There were a number of labs that were using what I would call definitions and procedures that have been around, and terminology, I guess, that have been around probably since the 50s when it comes to doing, you know, radiochemistry. This is almost like what I call an ad hoc way that it's been developed. They're well-defined, however, they don't necessarily match the definitions that we found from the other half of our laboratories, which tend to use the new multi-agency radiological laboratory analysis protocol manual, what is called the MARLAP manual. So what we ended up having was with all of our laboratories was pretty much a split, some using MARLAP language and some using the other language. And so what we decided to do as a group is we didn't want to really penalize anybody that's using things that are working for them, but we didn't want to penalize the laboratories that are moving forward and using more of the MARLAP language. So what we essentially did was we created a 5.0, or module 6, that really emphasizes both. So whichever terminology your laboratory is using will be acceptable to the assessors when they come out there, because MARLAP has, in a lot of ways, especially from the statistical side, has different ways of evaluating data than what is used, what I would call a more traditional approach. We don't want to penalize either side for using that. And I will state now, and this is my opinion, this is Fred's opinion, just from listening to a lot of DOE folks, so I'm not really speaking for them, but just seeing what they are looking at in their evaluations is we really are trying to make laboratories focus more on the MARLAP side of the definitions and things. So I would think, and this is to me a long-term future, you're going to see a shift away from the more traditional ways of doing radiochemistry into using the definitions and terminology that you find in MARLAP. Again, if you're not using MARLAP, you know, that's still acceptable. But that's, like I said, that's my opinion on just from listening to a lot of people talk about this. And so, and of course, I could be wrong. Maybe that's my one mistake for 2013. We now have for, we now have for our document three appendices. The first appendix I just want to talk about is the one that we have on that is still there on reporting requirements. And the only thing that we have done differently in Appendix A is we have added a new section, which really is right down in here. You know, when you use EPA documents and all the other documents that we've been using over the years, we've had all these crazy definitions of level 1, level 2, level 3, level 4 data packages. Sometimes we know what they are, but sometimes we don't. I guarantee you if you got 20 people, 20 chemists and lab people, project people, put them in a room and ask them to tell everyone to tell what level 1 through 4 meant, you'd get 20 different answers. So one of the things another work group of ours, DOD work group, is looking at is on essentially data validation. And one of the things that they've done, and they're actually working with the EPA group on this, is we wanted to standardize all these definitions of what level 1, 2, 3, or 4 means. Now, for the laboratory part of this, because this is what, you know, this document really refers to is the laboratories, what we tried to do is define for you what level 1 means. In other words, if a project comes to you and says, I need a level 3 data package, hopefully we can get everybody on the same page as to exactly what you as a laboratory has to provide in terms of information to your client without a lot of, you know, back and forth. So what we ended up doing is we have essentially copied these definitions of level 1 through 4 from the DOD EPA document that's being created, and kind of like just took those definitions and put them here. And essentially all Appendix A in just this one little section is just telling a laboratory, you know, what is a level 1 data package? What's a level 4? What do I need? Hopefully we can get within the next few years everybody on the same page to where there isn't so much back and forth as to, you know, whether something's missing or not, because we don't define levels of data packages the same. So essentially that was probably the one and only major change with Appendix A, was that little addition there. Appendix B, that's going to be our new quality control tables. We're now up to 19 tables. Hopefully each table, though, has been cut back significantly. A lot of what I would call redundant information, we just basically, like the DOC table parts and the LOD, LOQs and all this, has been eliminated. We also decided, you know, because it's so difficult to keep up with all the various versions of methods and all that are out there, and there are more coming every day, we have these tables listed really in terms of technology, you know, like gas chromatography, mass spec, liquid chromatography, ICP, all those various technologies that are out there. The only, I would say, exceptions to that was it was method 8330B, and that's only because of the sampling portion that's in there, makes it kind of unique, and, of course, your dioxin, furans, 8280, 8290, are very, very unique to that. So those were the only exceptions. The rest of them, we just pretty much kind of stripped out all the method numbers, but as far as our work group is concerned, I mean, every version of the methods have been parsed through very, very carefully up to and including the ones probably within the last 3 months that have been promulgated, have been gone through and compared to what our requirements are. We did create some new tables, one for chemical warfare agents, perfluorinated compounds, and four new RADCHEM tables, which we hope will help those, you know, in the RADCHEM community. As far as what I would call really significant technical changes, probably these are the most significant, what I would call technical changes in the tables that we've done. The grinding blanks, we used to require that you had one essentially between every sample. We've now collected enough data from enough different projects to show that that was probably now a little bit of overkill. So we've kind of stepped back from that and essentially said to do it after every 10 samples and at the end of the batch. So what we're kind of telling you, at least one grinding blank per batch must be analyzed. You can composite your grinding blanks depending on how large your batches are. If you want to, you're required to do a grinding blank after every 10 samples, but if you want to like combine all your grinding blanks into one analysis, you can do that. Of course, you run the risk of, you know, of failure. And failures mean you're going to go back and do a lot more work. But, you know, depending on how clean the samples are you are have been working with, that may be a viable option for you. Another technical change we had here was what I call the force through zero. We've had that probably for the last two versions of our QSM. And a number of laboratories have come to us and essentially told us that There are cases where you have to force through zero, mainly because of the software doesn't allow you to get around that. And what we've essentially gone back in that straight out ban where it says do not force through zero, we removed it from the table. But here at the very end of it, it says if applicable. So if any of our assessors go out there and see that you're forcing through zero inappropriately, that's still a finding. Just because you can do it doesn't necessarily mean you should, and you really should evaluate if you're doing that, whether you should be doing it or not. And so all we've done is in cases where you can't get around the force through zero, it allows you to do that. A lot of questions come up to us on surrogates and doing LOD and LOQ verifications. What we're basically saying for surrogates, second sources for surrogates are not required. So this is one exception to having a second source for everything. But you don't need a second source for your surrogates. However, we are still requiring LOD and LOQ verifications on surrogates. Not necessarily from a laboratory perspective, it probably doesn't really make a lot of sense or doesn't seem like it's necessary, but from a project's perspective, that's very, very valuable information. So we are still going to require LOD and LOQ verifications. Throughout the document, we made sure that the ICV and CCV requirements were as stringent as each other. There were a number of cases, depending on your EPA version method, they tended to flip-flop a lot, and so we just wanted to make sure that for our methods that the ICVs and CCVs are essentially going to be, ICVs are as stringent as your CCVs. And one probably the biggest change of all from a technical addition for us in Appendix B is for your GCMS methods, we're requiring now that you have to have an end-of-run CCV. But we do give you a little bit of more leeway. This actually kind of follows the protocols of the EPA CLP program in that we require it to be plus or minus 50% at the end of the run. Appendix C. These are our new LCS tables. 23 methods that we're up to now. For those on the phone that may not have participated or understood what we did, quickly this summer we collected LCS data. We had an independent statistician that looked through all of our data. They created a gigantic spreadsheet, essentially. They collected, around 6.2 million records were collected, LCS data, quite a lot of data, probably the largest collection in probably that's ever been done. So we took all that information, our assessor, our statisticians, they went through it all. While I'm here, I want to thank, if you're out there and you volunteered your data, I want to thank all of you that participated. You're now seeing your numbers. I have no idea who all you were, but I'm thanking you all anyway. But we had to make some decisions once we got all this data and got it all collated. As you might expect, there were a number of analytes, especially in the herbicide, pesticide methods, 8141 and 8151. There are a lot of really new, strange compounds that I had never seen before that are now being reported, which is kind of interesting. Some of these, we just don't have enough good recovery on. And so we made a decision out of the list of analytes that we saw, we made a decision that any analyte that had less than 15% recovery or its RSD was greater than or equal to 25%, we removed them from the Appendix C tables. No other adjustments were made to the limits. We just use the straight, you know, after reviewing and parsing through all the data, it's essentially the same as what I would say just about all the laboratories do. It's a kind of like a three sigma around the mean for all the data, all the laboratories that were put in there. We didn't make any adjustments to any of the limits other than we just rounded it off to the nearest whole number in those cases where we could round it off. And I want to also emphasize that none of this data is going to be missing. Even those compounds, we had a handful that essentially had 0% recoveries. What we're planning on doing is we're creating right now a separate LCS study that will go into all the details of how the study was performed and all the records that were generated, all the limits, and it's all going to be there so everyone can see. In terms of how we control data, we had to make a decision, and the decision as a group that we came up with was that any analyte less than 15% essentially wasn't going to be on the table. If those analytes were needed by a project, we would hope that the individual laboratories would have recoveries essentially better than zero or better than 15%, really. And so that's where your in-house control limits would come into play. And I'm going to reemphasize this again. Like I said, the most important change probably in version 5.0 is laboratories must use the Appendix C limits for batch control if they don't have any project limits given to them. And if those analytes aren't listed, they go back to their in-house limits. Well, that's pretty much it in terms of what we're doing with the new QSM. Probably the most important question of all, I guess everybody wants to know, is how are we planning on implementing this? We are now in what I would consider to be the final draft phase of this. We are now pushing the document up our chain of command for sign out. DOE is doing the same thing. How long is that going to take? Given, you know, our climate, you know, you all know this, of sequestration and all these other issues, we don't really know. We're at that point now where we've essentially completed the document and we're waiting for sign out. That could be, you know, next week, or it could be, you know, 3 or 4 months down the road. Given our previous timelines, I would suspect, and this is just a total guess, probably within the next 3 to 4 months it'll get signed out. Now, when it gets signed out, what we're planning on doing, and this is just for us, just for DOD in terms of our DOD ELAP accreditation, I will speak to that. What we're planning on doing is once the document is signed out, we are going to give like a 6-month window to get everyone familiarized with 5.0 and start taking some of these changes and adopting them into your systems. So we will start the accreditation process 6 months from signature of the document. And we expect to have, and you know, and it depends on, you know, each accreditation body and their review cycles and such, that, but we expect within, say, 2.5 years, all the laboratories that are now there on, under version 4.2 will now become version 5.0. And so that's how our implementation plans are going to be handled. Now, one of the things that has come up is questions on the new DOE QSM. How can they be addressed? I mean, we are the first to admit it's not a perfect document. We have a number of questions that's probably generated through this session and, as you know, in the next few days as you go through the documents. One of the things is I cannot answer questions directly. I'm always getting in trouble for doing that because I'm always off-the-cuff kind of guy and always give the wrong answer. And so, well, not all the time, but enough times to where I cause myself problems. And so all the questions that are on the QSM 5.0, if you think it requires further clarification, if you find any typos or anything in it that's contradictory or wrong, what we want you to do is go to our, we're collecting questions that are now being generated that refer back to the document. We are going to look at those questions as a group and take those questions seriously. Whenever you get an answer, it's just not my answer. It's our work group's consensus answer. We will go back with our DOD and DOE work group members, and we'll go back through them, and we'll parse the questions out and come up with an answer. So it not only becomes my answer, it becomes DOD and DOE's answer. And so we're collecting all these questions that are going to be generated through Gene, you know, and ClueIn today. We're also going to be collecting, you may have questions later on that you can go to, as you see below that Denix website, you can go there and also ask questions. We collect all those questions and parse through those with our work group, and we will have answers for you. And that's how we plan on handling. This is, like I said, again, I want to reemphasize, this is an open website. And so anybody out there that wants to have a question answered, go to the Denix website, and you can, any question you want to type in on the QSM implementation, those issues, and we'll try our best. We'll get answers for you.
Okay. Well, Fred, thank you so very much for that presentation. I just wanted to confirm that we do have about 2 dozen or so questions that have kind of been submitted throughout the presentation, and they continue to come in from our participants. As you've submitted your questions as an online attendee, you should have seen a note from me just confirming that I received your question and that we'll pass it on to the organizers after today's live broadcast. If you're in the middle of typing up your question, don't worry. We'll continue to leave the room open for some time and allow you to type those questions up electronically. And as Fred mentioned, we're going to go ahead and capture all of those questions and share it with him and his team to then get a response later on. If you're an individual who's watching the recorded version of today's broadcast, or you, again, have a question that comes up after today's session, you can refer to that Denix website. And if you're specifically browsing through, there's actually a button that appears on the left-hand side of that page that talks about contacting the team. And if you click it, it'll open up a form allowing you to submit your question to them directly online. So again, I'd refer people to that if you're watching this broadcast after the live delivery. Fred, were there any other comments or closing statements you wanted to make before I kind of walked people through other items in terms of how they can access resources and submit feedback?
Well, Gene, I just want to thank everyone that's been on this teleconference here. Essentially, this is the first time we've done this, and as you know, with how it came about, we could not hold our 2013 EMDQ conference, which I would have went over all this with. But I just want to thank everyone for participating. This stuff is not easy to digest, I understand, in like an hour and a half. So again, if there's any other questions that come up, the Denix website is available, and like I said, it may take time for a response. It's a consensus process, but we will certainly get answers to all your questions. And Gene, I just want to thank you and the ClueIn staff. This has worked fabulously. I really do like being able to, you know, talk with this number of people this way. So I want to thank you guys for all the work y'all have done.
Thank you. Just to give you a final headcount, you had nearly 450 individuals who were able to join you for today's live online broadcast. So we reached a very large audience today, and we do appreciate everyone who joined us for that live broadcast. I'm going to go ahead and go through some closing items and cover the most common questions. How can you get the materials? How can you share feedback? Can you get a certificate for participating today? So if you can hang on with me for just a few more minutes, we'll cover some of those important items. And then again, still keep this room open, so if you're in the middle of typing up your comment or question, you can continue to do so. So just a reminder, if you are interested in seminars like this, we do offer them almost on a daily basis through the Cleanup Information Network. We offer a number of electronic newsletters. You guys may be familiar with something called Tech Direct that you can sign up for free and receive on the first of each month to kind of learn about our upcoming training opportunities and new resources and documents in terms of cleaning up and characterizing hazardous waste sites. You can also connect with us, in addition, on our actual website at cluin.org, where you can simply follow us or friend us on popular professional and networking sites like Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. The other thing I want to remind people is, again, if you're looking for a copy of the presentation materials, that material is all available on the seminar homepage. So I'm going to refer you to one of two places. You can either follow the information you got when you signed up in your registration or reminder emails, again, to go to the seminar homepage. The actual slide materials are posted right on that page. We've also taken the DINX website and some other resources and put together what we call an additional resources page or links page. That's hyperlinked on the slide in front of you today. You'll also find that link within the Adobe Connect room under the related URL. So you go to something called the seminar links or the seminar homepage and follow the button to links and resources. You'll find those materials there. The other question we get is how to submit feedback. We do have a live feedback form. It's also available under the related URL. So you can click on that and the window will pop open to actually allow you to fill out a very short feedback form. We would ask if you could take just a moment to fill that form out. I do read each and every one of the responses for the feedback that we get, and we rely upon your feedback to continue to improve as well as maintain the online sessions that we're offering for free. So if you thought this was a valuable expenditure and you appreciated the opportunity to take this training online for free, please fill out that feedback form and let us know what you thought. If this is your first online training with us or using something like Adobe Connect, we also welcome your thoughts on the tool that we used and how we can improve it. If you shared the line with multiple parties, each individual person can actually fill out their own feedback form. So once you fill the form out once, there's a link that will appear to let the next person sit down and fill out their own form. If you're not actively connected to the Internet right now or don't have time to do that, that form is available, again, on the seminar homepage. You can come back to it at any time and fill it out. If you're one of the people watching the archived version of today's seminar, you too can still fill out the feedback form. Again, just follow the links under related URLs, click on the seminar feedback, and you can fill that form after the live broadcast. If you are looking to get credit or a certificate of participating today, we don't necessarily issue those directly through Cluin. However, a number of our attendees are able to get credit for participating from their particular institutions. I'd recommend that you keep a copy of your registration email, save a copy of the presentation materials or the seminar homepage as well, and if you fill out the seminar feedback form, there is a box you can check on that form to request a confirmation email to be sent to you, and it will at least verify that you submitted feedback after the live delivery. So if you take that confirmation email along with the materials from today's event, you'll usually be able to earn credit again from your training officer or accrediting institution. One big thing I need to point out is make sure you're very careful when you're filling out that feedback form. Make sure your email address is entered correctly. A lot of times people have typos in there and don't realize it, so they miss the confirmation email. If you still don't get it, check your junk inbox. Sometimes they accidentally get filtered out. But if you, again, miss it, you can always fill the form out again or simply contact me and we'll work to pull your feedback out and at least confirm that you did submit it. Today's session was recorded, and you will all automatically receive an email as soon as that archive is available. One of the things I'll also try to work with our organizers after today is to see if we can also include notifications if and when new answers to some of the questions that were posed today are also available on the DINX website. So I think that's the end of the reminders I have for closing out today's seminar. I just want to echo our organizers' thanks. I want to thank everybody who joined us from the Department of Navy, especially Skip Darley as well as Fred McLean. We really appreciate you guys working with us for today's seminar. And again, I also want to echo my thanks to the nearly 450 individuals who joined us from all over the country for today's DoD and DOE Consolidated Quality Systems Manual, or QSM, Environmental Laboratory version 5.0 training. Again, I hope everyone found this to be a valuable expenditure of your time, and that we'll either see you or hear from you on a future Clumen seminar. I know we're ending things a little bit early today, but hopefully everyone can take advantage of the extra 30 minutes or so in your day, and again, that you'll join us soon on a future Clumen seminar.